This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. David Crawley on the 27th of February, 2001, at approximately 9:20 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Crawley is in Rochester, Minnesota. Sir, why don't you go ahead and begin by discussing your early childhood, when and where you were born and where you grew up.
I was born in Rochester, Minnesota, 1949, small town, home of the Mayo Clinic, the average upbringing. Dad was a truck driver, mom a housewife, brother two sisters, and just typical.
Mm-hmm.
Grade school, and around 9th, 10th grade, started to become aware of the war in Vietnam, and not that my family was a rah-rah flag raising, but my grandfather being in World War One, and my dad being wounded in World War II, and his brother being in World War II, it was not expected that I go, but when I chose to go into the service, it was, well, that's what you do around here in the Midwest, you know, you owe your country something, and so I thought, well, I'm going to go in the Marines.
Okay. Now, did your dad and your uncle talk much about their World War II experiences with you?
My uncle didn't. My dad touched on it briefly. He was on the USS Birmingham and was wounded by a kamikaze attack, killing over 100 and some sailors and wounding him. And why, you know, he never put it in good or bad light, just the thing I remember most is when he was 17, he was a bellman at a hotel here, and everybody that was coming through the hotel would say, kept saying to him, why aren't you in the war? Why aren't you in the war? Why aren't you in the war? And he got tired of telling him he was only 17, so he went to his mother, my grandmother, and said, you got to sign me up.
Yeah.
And his brother was already fighting in the Philippines, and so he said, well, go in the Navy, because that's the safest.
Mm.
He got hit on that kamikaze attack.
My goodness.
And so all through 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, I knew that I wanted to join the Marine Corps, and from reading, I was always reading about the Marines in World War II and wanted to be, you know, part of the best of what we thought at that time. And so when I was 17, I got my dad and he to sign me up, although he didn't want to. He wanted me to wait till I was 18 and think about it more because he knew what war was about.
Mm-hmm.
But when he saw there was no deviating from that, that I was going to go in, whether you sign me up now or I wait 2 more months to be 18 was immaterial.
Mm-hmm.
So he signed me up when I was in my last year of signed the papers to allow me to sign up in my last year of high school, and August 7th, on my 18th birthday, I boarded a bus for boot camp.
And this was after you graduated from high school?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Wow. Now, were politics and the war much discussed in your family, you know, at dinner table and stuff?
Not at all. My dad, being a truck driver, was pretty much always gone. I went and lived with my grandmother from 9th grade on, and we never really talked politics, per se, of why. She'd just relate at the dinner table, relate stories to me of her husband and World War One, or things that her sons had told her from World War Two, but never, it seems, that I can remember politics. It was, we were pretty, ignorant, and it was just basically, this is the United States of America, you owe your country something, and that was it.
Okay. And, in terms of your uncle's service in World War II, which branch was he in?
The Army.
He was in the Army. Okay. How about your grandfather in World War One?
He was in the Army.
Okay. Now,
and I also had a great-great-grandfather in the 18th Tennessee Infantry during the War Between the States.
Wow. Okay. The Tennessee Infantry?
Yes.
What had
Confederates,
yeah.
I'm in that little genealogy here.
Uh-huh.
We've tracked down relatives, and it turns out my great-grandfather, Adolphus Crawley, left Tennessee in the late 1890s looking for land, because the land all around Tennessee where his dad, Lafayette Crawley, grew up, was pretty well destroyed, and we were farmers down there, and the lure of, you know, homesteading led him to come to Minnesota.
Wow. Okay. And that lure of homesteading, did he farm when he got there?
Yes. There's a small town outside of Rochester called Chatfield, and he had a farm down there, and raised six kids, one of which was my grandpa Leslie, and when World War One came along, Grandpa Leslie left the farm and went off to do that, to serve his country, and came back, went to farming, and had my married, had four kids of his own.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you had read about the Marines in World War II, and that kind of, I guess, had an influence on you choosing to go in the Marine Corps when you finally enlisted. I was, how about the effect of certain movies and things like that? Did you see many movies about the Marine Corps or the Marines? And
I don't remember seeing a lot of movies about the Marines, just reading books such as Battle Cry or things of that nature. I'd always, of course, heard about how the Marines are the toughest, and always wanted to be tough, so I thought, well, I'll join the Marines.
And how about John Wayne movies?
You know, I don't remember, per se, any John Wayne movies other than his cowboy ones. No, like The Sands of Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
I don't ever remember seeing that until I got out of the service.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let's see. What was when you were in school? Did you play sports and
I started to go into wrestling, but then the lure of money took me out of sports, and I got a part-time job.
Okay.
I didn't come from the dirt poor family, but I quickly saw, you know, if I wanted those two, three extra shirts or pair of pants, I was going to have to buy them myself. So. Because my grandmother just didn't have the money. My dad is just a truck driver on the road all the time. And there wasn't a lot of extra. I mean, there was food, but, I mean, if you wanted entertainment, you got it yourself. You worked for it and got it yourself, the money for it.
And how about your studies in high school? Was there anything that you enjoyed in particular?
Didn't really like school. I was not a good student, as with the case of so many of my friends in this era. Especially now, we all look back and say, and this is odd, because we say, thank God there was a war going on. I didn't know what the heck I was going to do after high school. I mean, the only thing I saw was, well, the girl I was dating, marry her and become a tile setter like her dad or truck driver like my dad, and that just didn't appeal to me. In fact, my father wanted me, every summer from growing up, I'd go on the road with my dad. He was a furniture hauler, and the older I got, the more I had to work. And even that summer after high school, he tried to talk me into going on the road with him again just for those few months before I went into the Marines in August. But I just had no desire to do that. I just wanted to get into the Marine Corps and get over to Vietnam. That's all I could think about. In fact, looking back on my high school yearbook, I see how everybody was signed it there, you know, my friend, good luck in the Marines, and you're crazy to go, want to go to the war and stuff. So it really, looking at things like that hit me of how vocal I was on, yep, I'm going in the Marines. And, in fact, Rochester, Minnesota at that time frame, I'm not saying it was patriotic, but, every single one of my friends went into the boot camp the summer of 67. Going to boot camp, my cousin was in the next platoon, and this guy down here was, you know, all the people that I kind of hung around with, we all wanted to be tough, and so we all went in the Marines in the summer of 67.
Wow. Now, what kind of work did you do when you were in high school?
Oh, just restaurants, like busboy.
Okay. You didn't start, like, an apprenticeship? Doing
no.
Stuff like you said, tile setting or something?
No, I figured there's no sense in doing that because why? I'm going in the Marines.
Okay. Well, what about anti-war sentiment at local universities or regional universities or anything like that? Had you heard about anybody who didn't think we were doing something right in Vietnam? before you went in?
I would see it touched upon on the newspapers mm-hmm. and a little bit touched upon on the nightly news. But Rochester, Minnesota at that time was very, well, the Midwest, mm-hmm. Around up here, very isolated. And we thought that, well, probably because of the 50s and early 60s, we thought, well, it's just communist agitation, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
We thought, well, how could these people, you know, of course nobody likes war, but how could these people not want to serve their country? I mean, that's just what I grew up with in the 50s and 60s, that this is America, and you owe your country
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
So when they said, we got us a war going in Southeast Asia, boy, you owe us something, I went, well, that made sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe, you know, going in terms of, you know, talking to the recruiter and figuring out what exactly you would do when you went into the Marine Corps. Or was there any discussion about what you would do?
At that time for the Marines, there was no doubt that you, 9 out of 10 of us, were going to go into the infantry and end up in Vietnam.
Okay.
And that's what I wanted.
Okay.
So just started talking to the recruiter a year before my senior year.
Mm-hmm.
And knew I was going to go in. And the only problem with that was there were so many people going in the Marine Corps, I couldn't get in till August.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated in June, and every slot, 2, 3, and 4 year, was filled with fellow area people going into the Marines. So I had to wait till August 7th. Couldn't even get in because everybody wanted to be in the Marines.
Wow. Okay.
So I just spent the summer kind of hanging around, so to speak, with my girlfriend and just waiting for my date to leave.
Okay. When did you know other people in your community, other young men who enlisted, went to Vietnam, and came back before you left?
No.
Okay.
No, the simply because you sign up for a 2, 3, 4 year, whatever, the people that I knew in 66
mm-hmm.
or a year ahead of me would come home after boot camp, and that would be the only time I'd see them.
Okay.
And, you know, hadn't told stories of the war because they hadn't been there yet, but
mm-hmm.
the stories of all of boot camp were everything I read about was what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tough and so that's just what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of the war, no, they didn't. Nobody had been to the war yet.
Mm-hmm.
This was 66, 67. It was really just starting for us here. Didn't really know anybody.
Okay. Well, what was your first impression? I guess you went to boot camp at MCRD San Diego.
Correct.
What was your first impression getting off the bus?
Well, getting off the airplane.
Oh, getting off the airplane, excuse me.
Yeah, there was a guy in a Smokey the Bear hat. And there's three different training centers in San Diego. There was Navy, Marines, and some Army outfit. Now, first thing that hit me was the Army guy. He goes, all you people going in the Army, our bus is over here. I remember the Navy guy going, all you guys going to the Navy, your bus is over here. And I remember the Marine going, all you sub bitches that are thinking you're going to be Marines, get on that fucking bus and shut your mouth. And I remember getting on the bus, and the drill instructor goes, keep your feet flat on the floor, your hands on your knees, your face is straight ahead, and shut up. And there was some black kid behind me, kind of, from Chicago, that was, yeah, who are you? And that guy came back and beat him up right there in the parking lot of on the bus at San Diego Airport. And that was I went, whoa. I think I'll just keep my mouth shut here and see what's going on. And then we got to MCRD, and he said, you know, started screaming immediately, going through the gates, get off this bus and get on those yellow footprints, and if you weren't moving fast enough, he'd punch you. Next thing that, this was at midnight, and we're all standing out there in the dark on these little yellow, they have little yellow footprints
mm-hmm.
to show you how to stand.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who was, and then there was like 5 or 6 receiving drill instructors walking up and down the line, just punching you
mm-hmm.
for any kind of infraction.
Mm-hmm.
Screaming and yelling, and I thought, whoa, hey, this is what I read about, but I could see some of the people that had no idea what they were getting into. For instance, one guy showed up with like 3-4 suitcases, and I quickly saw that people who were different attracted attention
mm-hmm.
and brought down the wrath of the drill instructors on them. So I knew right off the bat, keep my mouth shut, see what's going on, and there'd be plenty of other people to catch all the flack.
Mm-hmm.
And from there on, it was 2 months of everything that I had read and heard about.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't do things right, you got punished, and if one guy didn't do things, sometimes they'd punish everybody else to get him into line, and it was definitely a try to get us to work as a unit situation.
Mm-hmm.
Of which I, not because of my father or anything being in the military, but just from what I had read.
Okay. Now, so when you went through boot camp in 1967, physical contact between the DIs and the recruits was somewhat common.
Oh, every day. Every minute somebody was getting punched.
What did you think when you witnessed all this?
I said, well, I think you're obviously doing something wrong,
so
they deserve it.
Okay.
It's like when I was on the rifle range, two of us were called into duty hunt. We weren't hitting the targets. One was a tall black guy, and a little drill instructor stood on a chair. And he said, why can't you, you seem to be not hitting your target. What's your problem? And it was a black kid from Chicago. And he goes, well, sir, he'd never fired an assault rifle before, and he goes, I don't know which eye to close. The drill instructor punched him as hard as he could in the eye.
Ouch.
He said, now the one that's swollen up is the one you should have been shutting. Then he turned to me and he goes, I think you like it here. Oh, yes, sir, I want to be a Marine. Well, you're jumping all over the target, too, because you're excited. And he says, which finger do you shoot the trigger with? And I held up my trigger finger, and he put it in his mouth and bit the hell out of it. And he goes, there, maybe that'll settle you down.
Ouch.
So it was instances like that.
Uh-huh.
Constantly.
Uh-huh.
Constantly.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they never, hit you in the ear or the eyes, but, I mean, they were constantly just punching you in the chest or the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Or their favorite one was to put the fingers around your throat and choke your ear off.
Okay.
So it's just things like that over and over and over.
Yeah. Do you recall any particular recruits having a hard time coping with that?
Yeah, we had three within the first week take off, go AWOL.
Okay.
Of course, they caught him, but, I mean, we never saw him again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they weeded him out. As you went through boot camp, some guys who couldn't keep up with the program would go to what they called motivation platoon, where they really worked. They had big sand piles that make them run, move the sand pile back and forth across the base with buckets of sand. And I never wanted to go to motivation platoon, so I tried to always pay attention, do what I'm told, and shut my mouth.
Did the guys in Motivation Platoon wear anything differentiating or particular?
Nope.
Just their buckets of sand?
No, they just disappeared, and we'd see them hauling sand, as opposed to the PCP platoon, which was guys who were troublemakers. They ran around with sledgehammers all day, just working,
wow.
Rearranging their minds,
mm-hmm.
and more physical punishment.
Mm-hmm.
They never would come back, the troublemakers, but the motivation platoon would be gone for about a week, and then they'd come back, and they'd look at us and go, don't go there, do whatever they would be instantly transformed.
Uh-huh.
Whatever the drill instructor said, there was no more individual thoughts there.
Mm-hmm. When you said peace, was the PCP?
Yep, physical conditioning platoon.
And what were, you said they were the troublemakers.
Yeah, somebody that just couldn't quite, I thought they, people that did not realize to get with the program, people that thought they could think on their own instead of thinking like the Marine Corps wanted them to.
Mm. Was there a particular type of infraction that would get you in, like the Motivation Platoon versus the PCP?
The Motivation Platoon was usually fat bodies. People that couldn't keep up and so needed a little motivation to get them going.
Mm-hmm.
But this PC, maybe somebody that would smart off to the drill instructor, and even after being punched a couple times, et cetera, just still thought that, how to put this, still thought they weren't part of the outfit. They wanted to be individuals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the recruits that you went through boot camp with, were any of these guys compelled, as far as you're aware, compelled to go to boot camp?
Oh, yeah.
To avoid certain...
Oh, yeah.
personal problems with the law or something?
Oh, you bet. Back then, we had, I don't know exactly how many, but I remember five or six that were given the choice of going to jail or joining the service.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not any murderers or nothing.
No.
But I mean, trouble with the law, whether it be stealing or drinking or et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Or some people knock their girlfriends up and trying to hide out and get away.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And,
and quite a few of them were four-year college graduates. But at that time, no companies wanted to hire them in their various fields because why hire them and then train them and all of a sudden have them drafted?
Yeah.
So a lot of them said, God, I might as well get this military obligation over.
Okay. Interesting. So there were...
And they were picked on the most. The college graduates were really picked on.
How so?
They were singled out. Like, oh, little college boy, you think you're smarter than all of us in the group? Because most of the drill instructors were non-educated career lifers who had no college and were probably from the sons of really poor people, and the military became home to them, and they were fed and clothed, and they really had a disdain for the college-educated.
Mm-hmm.
And the only people worse than them were the reservists, people that... that we're going to only go to boot camp and a little bit of training and then go back to their hometowns and be reservists.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looked upon as pretty much cowards.
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't want to go to, because the big thing in the Marines were, what do you mean you want to go to Vietnam? That's where the Marines are, combat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess was there any tension or conflict amongst you recruits internally, or was
much a... they fostered that.
Okay.
They fostered a unit right on down to, at that time, there was Quonset huts.
Mm-hmm.
And every squad was in a different kind of Quonset hut.
Mm-hmm.
And there was four squads in a platoon, and there was four platoons in a company. And so there was, they were always fostering competition, not only between the different platoons, the different squads, but to see your individual leadership.
Mm-hmm.
They encouraged any kind of competition amongst individuals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were like this one big white kid, he was the toughest, maybe not the smartest, but through sheer force of his power, could beat people up and say, here's what we all got to work together. So you were always in competition for everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And did what was the toughest thing or the hardest thing for you in boot camp?
Well, because of my reading and because of my desire to be a Marine, I'm not going to say I was tough and didn't like being beat up, but I understood it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't have my feet at the right angle of degree at attention, or my hands weren't on my weapon properly, then I'd be punished, and I could understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And because I wanted to be there and wanted to be a United States Marine so bad, everything kind of rolled off my back. It wasn't that hard. I mean, I'd hear some guys crying at night and stuff like that, but for the most part, back then the Marines were not drafted.
Mm-hmm.
They joined, so if you were there, you pretty much wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't... the hardest part, of course, was mentally. The physical part didn't come until after boot camp when you went to ITR, Infantry Training Regiment, where you were at Camp Pendleton, and every day you'd get up at 4 in the morning and run to a different mountain range and fire a different kind of weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that, too, because I loved being in shape.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there was never a time that I said, God, I wish I'd have never done this. This is what I wanted to do.
Right. Right. Okay. And, I would imagine that you went through, hand-to-hand combat training?
Oh, yeah, well, hand-to-hand combat, we had, I think, one Saturday, we had 2 or 3 hours where we got to throw each other around, and somebody, you know, a few arms got broken and stuff, and that's hand-to-hand.
Mm-hmm. How about pugil stick training?
Oh, pugil sticks all the time, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that was fun.
how was that fun?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was like a sport.
Okay.
I mean, you had, you know, the stick with the big no, no, nobody's going to get killed because they were all, this, you know, the big, like, cotton balls on the end. And it was just seeing how, you know, whether you're lined up on a football field or whatever. So that was no big deal.
Okay.
You know, and of course you get all excited with your, you know, the drone instructors from the various platoons backing their own men and screaming at you. And that was all the whole thing, being screamed at all the time, exalted to do better, do better, do better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one of the things that when you were on your little runs, if guys would fall out, they fostered a, you take care of your buddy, somebody would take his rifle, somebody would take his pack, and two other people would take his arms, and you always bring your fellow Marine along. Because we're a unit.
Is there anything else that you want to discuss with regard to your boot camp and also ITR?
Well, boot camp was just that. It was August 7th, October 9th, the mentally stuff and learning Marine Corps tradition and Navy tradition and how to wear your uniform and pretty much the mental spirit core to make you a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the proudest days of my life was when you got to pass in review before the general because now you're Marines. I remember walking back to the barracks after the ceremony, and the drill instructors were all in our brand new uniforms, and the drill instructors going, "Hit the dirt!" And everybody immediately, without thinking, in their brand new uniforms, started crawling in the dirt like we were taught. And then he told us to stand up, and he goes, "There, now you're Marines.
Mm-hmm.
You did what you're told when you're told." And then we boarded buses, went to Camp Pendleton, and for the next 4 weeks, was learning all the different weapons and, like I say, going up to the different mountain ranges and shooting things.
Mm-hmm.
That took a month, and then on November 9th of 67, they specialized you down even further, sending you to a different part of Camp Pendleton, where you were either 0311 infantry, 0331 machine guns, 0341 mortars, and I got put in 0351, which was a combination of flamethrowers and 3.5 rocket launchers, the old bazookas from World War II.
Okay.
And then a month of that, learning how to handle that, home for a 21-day leave, and then back to staging, which was back at Camp Pendleton for another 21 more days of more Vietnam-type things going. They had mock villages set up. All these people teaching us, all from ITR to BITS, which was the basic infantry training with the rockets and stuff, were all back in Vietnam, and that was my first taste, and all these guys knew what the horrors of war were, and they didn't put hands on so much, but they let it be known that, hey, you want to come back without arms and legs and stuff, just don't learn what we're trying to teach you, and that's when it became real, because these guys had all been to Vietnam, and knew what the score was.
Well, did they, did your trainers in boot camp and ITR and after, did they speak about specific experiences they had in Vietnam and how the training that they were conducting in that particular moment was relevant?
Yes, they did.
Okay. Anything that you recall? Or?
Oh, just the basic general the ones of when you get to Nam, you're gonna, the most important person is going to be the guy on the foxhole with you, and so you better, the whole thing was you better be a good Marine and not let another Marine down.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really sit down and tell specific firefights and stuff. It was just a general view of here's what's going down in Nam, people are getting killed, just salt villages, and you better keep your rifle clean and watch out for your people around you.
Okay. And speaking of rifles, what you at this point you were trained primarily with the M14?
Boot camp was the M14, which was soon to be on its way out because the summer of 67 they replaced it in Vietnam with the M16. And then in ITR, the infantry training regiment, all the 16s were being sent to Vietnam, so they and the 14s were not yet recalled, so they gave us M1 Grands from World War II. That was one thing about the Marines. You always had the old equipment.
What did you think about the M1 and the M14?
Well, I liked the M14. It was a .308 caliber. It went a long ways, and it was a heavy duty. I mean, I've been used to shooting rifles coming from Minnesota here, whether you had sixes or whatever. And so it just was, you know, and our parents back in those days would trust you, you know, at a very the M16 was till I got to Vietnam because of its smaller caliber.
And you hunted as a young man?
Yes.
What did you hunt?
Deer, pheasant, quail, rabbit.
And for the deer, you'd use like a 308 or?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so you didn't get exposed to the M16 until you got to Vietnam.
Until staging battalion we fired for the first time.
Okay, what did you think when you first fired?
Well, it seemed okay in training because you just shoot a few rounds at the target and practice your fire team rushes, your various military maneuvers of villages or crossing rivers, and so I didn't really understand. Not having shot at a person before, I didn't really understand the difference that caliber was going to make. Because the .223 caliber for the M16 was so much smaller that it would be deflected by bushes, the wind, rain, and plus when it finally would get to the target, meaning the North Vietnamese, being such a small bullet, I quickly found out that it took two or three more bullets to kill the enemy than it would with the M14, which distressed all of us Marines being trained at the M14.
Okay. And did your trainers, the DIs and whatnot, did they talk about the efficacy of having the M14, the fact that you have this larger round? Did they talk about these types of issues at all? Or?
No, I don't remember that at all through any of my training about, the pieces of the M16 is a piece of crap and the M14 is great. I never heard any of that. It was just, here's what the Marines gave these trainers to use, and they taught it to their best of their ability.
Okay. Now, what was your 3.5 rocket training like?
We just, once again, go to various mountain range in Camp Pendleton there, and they'd have, like, old tanks or things like that set up downrange, and you just took turns practicing and familiarizing yourself with this weapon, because that's what I was going to be carrying at Vietnam.
And this was a...
like a bazooka?
Yeah, a bazooka.
And it shot high explosive rounds or white phosphorus, right, like napalm, little napalm rounds. And the reason they trained us on those, because a lot of times the North Vietnamese would be holed up in bunkers and stuff, and this would go through into the dirt, you know, really heavily built up wood, logs, stuff like that, and go through it.
Okay. But this is a crew-served weapon?
Correct.
And
how three of us.
Yeah, three of
them. One carried the tube, then you had an A-gunner that would be loading him, and if he got killed, he took over, and then an ammo hopper who would have an M16 and carry a bunch of extra rocket rounds.
Mm-hmm. About how many rounds would the team carry?
As many as you thought you could, meaning the gunner would carry one and the two, the ammo humper would carry, or the A-gunner would always carry one or two, and then the ammo humper would carry two or three, or as many as he physically could carry, being a small guy or a big guy, and then you'd always have extra ones farmed out, so to speak, to non-rocket people, just like machine gun ammo. They took rockets away and put me in machine guns. You'd always farm out extra gun ammo to the other grunts in your outfit. Everybody was always carrying extra, you know, or an extra radio battery, or an extra rocket round, or an extra gun and claymore, as much as you could carry.
Okay. How much, do you recall about how much each round weighed?
9 pounds.
Okay. So that's quite a bit of weight.
Yeah, it was, especially when you got all your own gear and then in your pack.
And if you're carrying that tube?
Pardon?
If you're carrying the tube.
Yeah, and the tube, yeah.
I would imagine that weighed quite a bit as well.
I'm trying to remember. I think that was like, 13, 14 pounds.
Okay.
Still better than when I carried the machine gun. That was 21 pounds.
M60 or?
60, yep.
Okay. So, and did you receive 60 familiarization training at ITR?
Yes.
Okay. But your specialty was the 3.5?
Yes. Okay. 3.5.
Yeah. Right. Well, when you got back for your, after your ITR, after your bazooka training, and you said you went through additional 21 days of training.
Well, yeah.
Familiarization, I guess, for what you would...
21 days leave and then right back to Camp Pendleton.
Okay. And you went to, they had mock villages set up, stuff like that. Was this where you were assigned to a unit that you went through this training and went to Vietnam with? Or?
Correct.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and talk about that?
Each group of people, it was called the staging battalion, mm-hmm. and pretty much the people that you were with in that staging battalion were going to be on the airplane mm-hmm. with you going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether you, once of course you got there, you, depending on where the Marines needed you, what outfit had the most empty billets, because people being killed is where they put you.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know what outfit I was going to until I got to Okinawa.
Now, throughout this period, did they talk much about the combined action platoons in Vietnam?
Not really. I really don't remember having any knowledge of a combined action platoon until about 6-7 months into my tour. They came around asking for volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what's a combined action platoon? They said, well, that's about 11, 12 Marines with a Navy corpsman working with the villagers.
Mm-hmm.
And after being there 6-7 months, I went, no, I kind of like having hundreds of Marines around me.
Okay.
I'm not going to do that. In a way, it was easier because you were closer to villages, but to me, it always seemed more dangerous because you could never really trust the Army of Republic, the Armen, mm-hmm. that you were working with, the popular forces, because they just lived in this village, and they were going to be there long after you were gone, and mm-hmm. I heard a lot of stories of these combined action platoons being hit,
mm-hmm.
and the people they were fighting with all of a sudden turning on them.
Hmm. Okay. Well, all right, before we get to that point in your experiences in Vietnam, when you finished your training, that 21 days of training, about that training, the mock village and stuff like that, how realistic did you feel that was, especially when you finally got to Vietnam?
It gave you a basic idea of the villages and stuff, but of course they couldn't portray the they couldn't portray, of course, going to an actual village with people in it and having them stare at you and hate you and things of that nature. It was a village, and we're walking through it in training, and they'd say, here's what might happen. They'll jump out of a spider hole or something. But and so you were always ready for that, but it was the people that was missing to teach you that prickly feeling on the back of your neck. Is this little kid going to come up and say, give you candy or a hand grenade, or are the people going to sell you Coca-Cola with slivers of glass in it, things like that.
Okay. And throughout all this training, when instructors referred to the Vietnamese, how would they talk about them?
Oh, they were always gooks.
Always gooks.
From everything from boot camp to ITI, when you were about to be given a lesson, mm-hmm. so that they could see the back rows, they'd always say, first two rows down, and you'd drop to one knee and you'd go, kill, kill, kill the gooks.
Okay. Did you have any personal thoughts on that kind of training?
I didn't think, oh, this is derogatory and stuff. I just thought, well, they're gooks. My dad called them gooks. The Korean vet called them dinks. They were just the gooks. Because
mm-hmm.
they're Oriental.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really think much of, ooh, that's derogatory to them or nothing. It's just what they were called.
Mm-hmm. You didn't feel like they were trying to dehumanize?
Of course that's what they were trying to do, mm-hmm. but at the age of 18, I did not consciously realize that,
mm-hmm.
that they were trying to dehumanize them. You heard from growing up, Grandpa called the Germans krauts,
mm-hmm.
Orientals were gooks, and mm-hmm. British people were limeys. And
mm-hmm. Okay.
So I never thought, they shouldn't be calling.
Yeah.
You never thought of that.
Right. Okay. Now, so why don't you go ahead and describe the trip over.
Okay, January 21st, 1968, we loaded our buses, went to El Toro Air Force Base, and got on a 747 with stewardesses and everything, and we stopped in Hawaii for 15 minutes to refuel, and then a long plane flight to Okinawa, which had three bases, major Marine bases on it, and while logistics, the K paperwork went into effect, you were at one of these camps, mm-hmm. Waiting to see which part of Vietnam you were going to go to. And you just train. Just run, refire your weapons, classes, taking down your rifles, but mostly physical. Run, with packs on your back to get you in shape. Because all these people, once again, were instructors coming back from Vietnam, and they knew that the big thing was the physical, mm-hmm. pumping all that gear. Mm-hmm. So I was on Okinawa, Camp Schwab for 9 days, and in the middle of the night, we boarded C-130 transport planes and flew into Da Nang, a short hop into Da Nang by February 2nd. Mm-hmm. And by then, I guess the logistics had said we were going to go to 3rd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment. Mm-hmm. So at that time, they were on what was called the float phase. There's always a battalion of Marines on a ship somewhere, mm-hmm. even nowadays, mm-hmm. For hot spots and stuff to be ready to carry out America's interest. Mm-hmm. So they put us on a ship, the Whitfield County. We sailed up the coast. We helicoptered over to the USS Valley Forge, which was an old aircraft carrier from World War II. They had converted into a helicopter, LPH, landing platform helicopters, and that theoretically you were supposed to go up and down the coast landing at hot spots. But by this time, the Tet of 68 had hit, and once you got in country, you were going to stay there. But I'll never forget, all those green recruits were sitting on the flight deck waiting to go in country. It was the monsoon. And I'll never forget that first chopper. They all of a sudden they said, "Everybody move down to this end of the ship right now." And we all got down there. So these choppers go at them and land. And we saw all these dead and wounded guys coming off the choppers from the outfit we were going to go to. They had just had a huge firefight. And there was, 40, 50 dead, wounded. And that was when I kind of thought, this is going to be interesting. I couldn't really quite, from a distance, you can't really see pain, suffering, guts and stuff. But I thought, I guess my dad might have had something here when he begged me to go into the Navy. And so February 10th, the weather cleared up. They put us on helicopters, CH-46s, and choppered us inside. And me and my buddy Stan from Missouri still talk about how coming in over the ocean, where we were at was called the Quaviet area. There was a river system up there, and it was all sand, just like the beaches of World War II, and all the trees were shattered, just like I'd seen all the movies of World War II, and it was familiar.
Mm-hmm. Now, in January, before you left from Okinawa, it was Okinawa, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Before you left from there, you said, I'm curious, did you hear anything about the outbreak of the Tet Offensive?
No.
Okay.
No, I had no conception of Tet.
No one talked about it.
That was the Vietnamese New Year.
Right.
No, I just...
How about before you left to go inland, when you were out there on the...
The ship?
The ship.
I really can't remember anybody saying anything about Tet, so to speak, that this is the big push and stuff. Uh-huh. I just knew a lot of people were being killed, and there seemed to be we just thought of it as a enemy offensive,
mm-hmm.
not putting together how big an offensive it was, like this was their do-or-die type year.
Yeah. Okay. And what were your... when you first landed in Vietnam, what were your first impressions when you got off the aircraft there?
Oh, well, outside of, like I said, looking around and seeing all the sand, it reminded me of World War II beaches. We're all standing there waiting to be told what to do, and I look up and here's these two filthy, bearded, ragged people coming down the line shaking us, and I shaking hands. And I remember, welcome to the outfit, and I thought, look at this, our own little welcoming committee. So they got to us, and he goes, and I remember these two guys went, I'm Captain Regal, this is our first Sergeant Riley, and my first thought was, oh my God, the officers look like this. Holy shit, this is really bad. Uh-huh. Because up until that time, officers were kind of a held in high esteem, and they were always squared away, clean shaven, and I thought, boy, to see an officer like this, I thought, this must be really bad.
Uh-huh.
So then they assigned us to the different platoons, and they took us out to this bomb crater. And here was a bomb crater that they had thrown all the dead bodies from that one firefight we had seen them bring on the ship. And there was hundreds of dead Vietnamese bodies in there. And they had us all shoot into this hole, saying, "There, now these guys are dead, and that's what it's like to shoot people. But the next ones you'll be seeing are alive." So,
interesting.
That was, you know, I'd never seen that many dead bodies in a big hole like that. And I kind of, there was no, you know, disgust or nothing. I mean, as an 18-year-old, your mind was, "I've never seen that."
Mm-hmm.
And another friend of mine at the reunions, we still talk about going out on our first patrols. My friend Randy goes, "You remember crossing that bridge and seeing that one goop that was stuck in the sand? There was two legs stuck in the sand. It was blown apart from the waist up." And I said, "No, but I remember that one goop laying there. He had been shot in the head, and he hadn't totally decomposed yet. So his skull being shot open, but skin was still holding the section of his skull together." And I remember it flapping in the breeze going, "Man," I mean, I was not, there was no horror because I'd never seen this, and it was more of a curiosity of, "Oh my gosh, look at this." Then the next week, until we reached my first firefight, it was just sweeping through villages and seeing what they meant about the people, keep it very quiet to themselves because what the heck going on?
Mm-hmm.
They were, of course, scared to death because they were going to be killed by us or the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
All these people were farmers, wanted to be left alone.
Okay. Now,
you know, it was cold. It was a typhoon going on at the time. I remember thinking for Vietnam, because, well, we were up north by the DMZ there. It was cold, 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 which surprised me, because I thought Vietnam was hot, hot, hot.
Mm. When you say cold, well, what temperature are you talking about?
It was a rainy, sleety cold. So, I suppose it was in the 30s for over there and stuff.
Mm.
But it was just that bitter, biting cold that from the rain, the monsoons were going on.
Mm-hmm.
And January 31st was the last day. I've learned this since going to reunions, that the sun shone till March 17th, so there was no sun. I remember it being overcast, overcast, overcast.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was your area of operations and what was the specific unit, that is, from your squad or platoon up?
There was three platoons and a company, 1st, 2nd, 3rd platoon and a company. I was in Kilo Company. We operated with three other battalions. There was four companies and a battalion, Kilo, Lima, India, and Mike.
Mm-hmm.
There's supposed to be three squads and a platoon, but everybody was getting killed so fast, there was only two squads.
Mm-hmm.
In a squad, you'd have a gun team, a rocket team, radio man, corpsman, M79 man,
mm-hmm.
and then a bunch of guys with M16s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like in Alpha Squad,
mm-hmm.
first squad of the first platoon of Kilo Company, and then those four companies and a battalion,
mm-hmm.
three battalions in a regiment, 1st Battalion, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Battalion of the 1st Marine Regiment,
mm-hmm.
of which was part of the 1st Marine Division.
Okay. So you were in the 3rd Battalion.
3rd Battalion of the 1st Marine Regiment.
1st Marine Division.
Of the 1st Marine Division.
Okay. And
there was 5th Marine Regiment,
right.
1st Marine Regiment, 7th Marine Regiment, and all of these regiments had 4 battalions.
Right. Yep, and what was your area of operations principally?
We were 6 miles below the DMZ in the Quaviet River system,
uh-huh.
and what had happened is our job was to clear that waterway because it was shutting down our resupply to the various Marine units further west towards the caisson.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Route 9, the main highway that ran east-west from the sea to caisson into Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And our job was to reopen the waterway, securing all the clearing, all these villages that the North Vietnamese had dug into.
Mm-hmm.
And then Route 9 was, like I say, the major highway, of which were located various Marine Corps bases, Camp Carroll, Dong Ha, etc.,
mm-hmm.
and were always under siege during Tet of 68.
Mm-hmm. And did you conduct many operations into Oh, boy. You were awfully close to Huey.
We were north of Huey. At the same time, when the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines was fighting in the Quaviet, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and Delta were fighting down around Huey.
I got you. Okay. So you never fought...
Just like the 26th Marine Regiment was already at KSOC with their all 3 battalions together, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd.
Okay.
A whole regiment trapped at KSOC. So, you know, we just come up to a village, and you could usually tell if the North Vietnamese had dug in, because all the villagers, the minute they'd see us coming, would start grabbing their kids and livestock and run out, because the North Vietnamese had dug in that village and were saying, just come get us.
And when did you actually go on your first patrol?
The next day.
The next day after arriving?
Yep.
Okay.
We started going through villages, a couple of them. For about the first week, we just sweep, and we didn't hit any contact until February 17th. And then that's in my letter there of what happened.
Right. What kind of river support did you have in terms of patrol boats and things like that? I mean, you're
well, the
right
Navy
there.
Had a landing craft they'd fare, they'd go up and down the rivers with, bring it. Supplies, food, extra ammo and stuff. There was that, or of course helicopters coming from the rear areas, bringing out bullets, beams, and bandages. Most of the time the Marines rode around across the rivers on Amtraks. And as far as support, that could all not good or bad, but what I'm trying to say, you never knew in a war situation. It's just, for instance, one day we were sweeping next to the river to give these Navy landing craft, like in World War II, the fronts come down. They had those on the rivers, and one of the Navy guys got overexcited, thinking we were the gooks, and opened up on us. He shot a guy's arm off. Our own guy. Hey, it's the Marines, Oh. So you never knew, who was going to get you.
Were there many friendly fire incidents?
In our outfit, there was a few, but every single Marine outfit had friendly fire incidents. Whether you're out on a patrol that's right next to another Marine outfit's position, they'd open up on you, or vice versa, or the Chets, when they'd come in to bomb a village sometimes, but they didn't come in low enough, like the Air Force never did. We never liked the Air Force to give us air support, because they were so afraid, they'd just drop their bombs from way up, and sometimes it'd fall on us. But the Marine pilots would come in so low, you could see their faces in the canopies, and they'd wave to you. So there was always a friendly fire incident of not only things like ambushing each other, but like sitting around waiting to go on a mine sweep of Route 9 one day, all of a sudden we heard a round go off, and some guy playing around with his M16 shot the guy next to him in the leg. I mean, there was that stuff all the time.
Okay. And what were your first impressions of the Vietnamese civilians that you had contact with there those first days?
Seeing how scared they were, and they did what they could to survive. I'm assuming they were as nice to the North Vietnamese coming into their villages as us, meaning they learned you stay in your house, wait till you find out who's going to tell you what to do before, and they would never go out in their fields and work until after light, because anything else in the dark, if you're out moving around, we can kill you. So they'd have to wait till daylight. Just looked, I went, here's a guy and his wife, a couple of raggedy kids, and they didn't have nothing, and, you kind of felt sorry for them.
Okay. And what, did you ever have early contact in the first week or so with ARVN units, ARVN Marines, regular Army Vietnam people?
We didn't work with the ARVN. My outfit did not work with the ARVN until about 5 months later.
Okay.
Until then it was all I saw was different Marines.
Well, why don't you go ahead and describe your first patrol where you actually made enemy contact.
All right. We had moved out that morning, and we're approaching a village, when all of a sudden I saw up ahead of me one of the Marines pumping his arm up and down. In Marine Corps lingo, that means to hurry up. Now, my first thought was, this guy wants me to run all the way across this rice paddy dike with all this stuff on me. So, and I thought he was pumping furiously, so I started trotting. And I thought he was getting madder and madder. And when I finally got up to where he was at, they had, everybody was jumped down behind this dike, and they said, "Get down behind this dike." And my first thought then was, now he wants me to get my feet wet. And I was about to say that when he reached up, grabbed me, and pulled me down into the water. And as I came up ready to fight, he goes, "Hey, you idiot, we're getting hit." And that's when I started to hear the rifle rounds. What had happened was three of the North Vietnamese, we'd been pushing them back out of the Qua Viet area, and three of them had stayed behind and hidden in this little French house. A lot of the villages up north had stucco houses because it was heavily influenced by French plantation owners. Anyway, three of them had holed up in this house and calmly waited for us to enter the village. Our point man, an individual by the name of Cloran, not seeing anything in the village, and it was real quiet, started to walk up these steps. One of the North Vietnamese stepped out of the doorway and shot him in the chest once, and then stepped back inside the house. They didn't kill him right away, and then they just sat there waiting while the rest of us surrounded the house. They knew they were going to die, but their job was to hold us up. So we surrounded the house, and everybody started shooting rounds at the house, and every now and then they'd lean, point their AK-47 out of the window and shoot Cloran a few more times. I was in rockets. They called rockets up to come up and blow the house up, and when we got there, Cloran was still alive, so we informed our squad leader, "Well, if we shoot this house with this rocket round, it'll kill Cloran too," so we did. Everybody just kept shooting, and at that moment, I heard them saying, another man, a Marine by the name of Cousins, whether he was going to, he tried to save Cloran, and in rushing the house or trying to sneak up on him, they shot him in the neck. Well, we dragged, one of the other Marines dragged him back. At that moment, they said, "Rockets, since you're not going to be utilized," they said, "send your extra man to the rear of the house for security," and that was me. So I low crawled in the water all the way to the rear of this house, and there was Cloran, Cousins laying there. Corman was working on him, and I'll never forget the blood spurting out of his neck into a high arch. And as I'm sitting there mesmerized by this, I heard somebody say, "Cloran's now dead," and so we really stepped up the firepower, and in the next number of half hour, 45 minutes, our machine gunner Bates caught one of them in the doorway and killed him, and another guy named Rawls was on the other side. He got shot another one through the window, and the third one tried to make a break for it out the back, and then everybody shot him. At that point, we tore the door off a hooch, put Cousins on it, and me and three other guys dragged him through the paddies back to a helicopter and put him on to try to save him to get to the hospital. And I learned he died a day later. And when we got done doing that and came back to the village, I saw my first dead Marine, and it was Tom Cloran. And at this time, at this stage of the war, a lot of the Marines were going out into the field without proper equipment, meaning poncho liners and Vietnam boots and things of that nature. And I was one of the new guys, and I still had my stateside leather boots on and didn't have jungle boots. And I'll never forget, they took me over to where he was laying there, and they took a knife out and cut his shoelaces, took his boots off, and they said, "Here, you guys are the same size, you're going to, you know," and they gave me his boots. And I'll never forget that. And that's when the other guys in my rocket squad offered me a cigarette. I'm a non-smoker, and well, I guess a lot of guys after combat started to smoke, but I just said no. time in shock, and that was my first time of seeing the dead Marines. And then we hauled out the dead bodies of the North Vietnamese, and we pulled back outside of the village, called in a couple of artillery rounds, and they sent a tank up. We had a tank attached out to us, and then we went back through the village, and they had found another one that was hiding in a straw pile or a hay pile, and they dragged him out. And the big thing I learned in that war was to get the enemy, if they were captured, to get them out of the hands of the lower echelon people, such as myself, because just being 18 and 19 year olds, not realizing how badly information was needed about the enemy, we usually, as I saw, a career soldier or a captain or a lieutenant could get to them quick enough, they'd usually survive. Otherwise, I'd see that we'd beat the hell out of them and probably kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was February 17th, my first bit of combat.
Mm-hmm. Now, the guy that you guys found, pulled him out of the haystack or whatever, he was still alive?
Yes. And from the artillery rounds, he was burned. But I remember looking up, and as I dragged him back, three Marines just jumped on him and just, they didn't out-and-out kill him, but they were beating him up so bad he would have been dead in a matter of time if a lifer, meaning career, had have intervened and said, no, we got to get him back to the lieutenant to question him.
Mm-hmm.
What outfit are you in? How many people are with you?
Right.
That's the last I saw of him.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still in a little bit of wonderment. There was at that time no patriotic feelings or hate for the enemy. I was just pretty much stunned.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until we hit a few more villages and had more Marines killed that a form of hate started to take over me like it did everybody else. But it was such a broad, directed hate at the enemy, and there was no understanding of domino theories and pacification. It was just, this is the enemy, and they taught me to hate them, and I did.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did you feel when you were given this fellow Marine's boots? I mean, he was just killed, and here you're supposed to now put on the boots of a dead man.
Actually, what had happened was I'd been kind of complaining, hey, I don't got my jungle boots, and for about 2-3 days before that. And so I never forget the squad leader. He goes, here's your fucking jungle boots. And I put them on, and I was just numb. And here was this guy laying there with all these bullet holes in him, and they finally threw a poncho liner over the top part of him where he was. And I was just numb. Went back to the, went back to my three-man team rockets and
mm-hmm.
platoon. Those guys had been there a while, and like they said, well, this is what it is. Thanks, man. We just go through the villages and kill people, and that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, okay. I was just still stunned, not shocked, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Amazed at what dead people look like, amazed at how just this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point of early 68, it was funny, that war dragged on so long that each year has a different tone or theme to it. And at that year, Nixon, the elections were going to come up in 68,
mm-hmm.
the fall of 68, and 65, 67, 68, and we thought this war will be over, we're America, and we will win, and the South Vietnamese will have so-called freedom that they told us why we were there. There was just a belief system of this is what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, well, okay, people are dying, but this is war, and we're going to win, and we're doing good, and my country sent me over here to do this and this and this, and, well, I guess this just has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until village after village and death after death that politics of war became totally immaterial, and as everybody around me, all I wanted to do was kill North Vietnamese.
Now, did any other Marines that you served with display any open superstitions or?
Well, people would do different things. Everybody mm-hmm. had their own little superstition.
Mm-hmm.
Like this one black guy, whenever we got in a firefight, would always take his helmet off and put his we had these soft covers, ballpark, ball cap type, and he'd always turn it around backwards like the kids do today, or some people would wear certain things, the cross, or where you carry something a certain way, or when you're setting up at night, do different things. Everybody did their own individual thing that would assure them of survival. Mm-hmm. Dig a deeper hole, or wear your bandoliers of ammo a certain way in case you got shot in the chest. Hopefully that would deflect the bullet. Everybody did their own little things. Mm-hmm. But nothing as far as religious. At the age of 18, yes, my grandmother had taken me to Methodist Church and stuff like that, but there was no religious tone to... At first you're just amazed at how easy it is to kill people. And you don't really think about these people have family too, and they got little kids maybe back home, it was just a blanket. This is a war, and this has to be done for America to win and assure another country's freedom.
So when you were with Kilo Company, you stayed in the Quiviet River region.
We stayed there all of February and all of March, and then as we cleared this area, they moved us more and more west towards Kaysan, and they put us on there was this major road, like I say, running east and west, and there was a place called Camp Carroll, which is a big Marine base that was sitting right up in the mountains, and we'd run patrols up out of there and try to protect the bridge positions to have the trucks go back and forth. But it was about March, they finally shut down the entire road to Kaysan, so it had to be supplied by air.
Okay.
And all we did is try constantly to run battalion-sized operations up in the mountains, hoping to run into North Vietnamese, which we always did.
Okay.
And thus ensuring another firefight.
Yeah.
Because, if you want, I can send you different maps of each of the different bills. All four of the line companies, when it came time to come up to a bill, Lima, Kilo, India, and Mike would have a different chance of assaulting the village first, because all you did usually was get in a big, long line and start running towards the village, shooting. And if you got killed, you got killed. And if you made it into the village, and you'd secure that little spot. And from there, they'd feed more Marines into that spot. Then you'd work your way down the trench lines and throwing grenades into the bunkers or killing them when they came out of the bunkers. Because usually they get in them bunkers. I mean, this is where I'm sorry I don't live closer to you, because I got four photographs, or four photo albums of... Nothing but pictures of us. And it turns out we even had for the Stars and Stripes, a movie photographer there.
Right.
I have an actual movie, 8mm film of us up in the Quiviet area, assaulting villages, dragging back dead and wounded, getting prisoners, incoming, and all that.
Wow.
I'd love to send you a copy if you'd like.
That would be awesome. Have you had that transferred to VHS yet?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. A friend of mine went to the archives, my buddy down in Missouri went to the archives, and of course they're not cheap, they charge you to look everything up, and there was even satellite photos before the sun disappeared, the cloud cover came over of the Quiviet system, showing all the little areas and stuff. But I'll make a copy, an extra copy of this tape.
Thank you. Excellent addition to your collection. Now, in the Quiviet, was the enemy that you were engaging here, was it a mixture of Viet Cong and NVA?
No,
or
it was all North Vietnamese regulars, the 802nd Battalion Regiment.
802nd NVA Regiment?
Yes.
Okay. And when you would assault these villages, was it already known to be clear of civilians, or...
Well, like I say, that's how you... Usually they weren't, but as we would come up to a village, sometimes the North Vietnamese would let the villagers run away, and sometimes they wouldn't, knowing how careful we would be to try not to kill women and little kids. And sometimes they'd let them stream out, and then we'd just call in a few artillery rounds and then rush towards the village. That'd be in the daytime. And at night, we'd sit in a big circle. Each company would sit in a big circle, so no matter what side they would try to attack you from, you'd be ready. But usually about 3:34 in the morning, they'd hit you with a human wave. They'd tie, the first wave would tie big wires around their arms and their legs to kind of numb themselves, and they'd shoot up with heroin and stuff. But their job, the first wave's job, was just to take all your bullets so that the second wave could get close to you for hand-to-hand.
Did that tactic work much?
You bet it did. Because sometimes they'd hit only one side, and all rush, and you'd only shoot, you know, you can only shoot so much. And as you're reloading, and it's 3:30 in the morning, and it's pitch black, and they'd get sometimes through your lines, and then you'd have to go up and down the line and kill the ones that got through. And usually you'd just stay in your foxhole and fight from there. Usually what they'd do is they'd wait for the M60 machine guns to open up, because that's your main firepower, and then the Northeast would run and try to overrun that main position. And that way they get inside your wire, your circle. But it was always 3:34 when you were just beat, you're drifting off, you got a two-man hole, you set in at 10 at night, and with two guys in a hole, one guy'd sleep from 10 to 12, and another guy would take over 12 to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 6, get up at 6 and start moving out again. So they'd always hit you when you were real tired and it's cold, you're sitting in the hole full of water and you're trying to keep awake, and that's when they'd usually come.
And when you say they would send human waves after you, what size units?
A couple hundred.
Was that standard?
Yeah. Or even more, depending on whatever outfit you were firing. I mean, there was a buddy of mine here in town, his entire company got wiped out. He got shot three times, and he remembers the North Vietnamese going through his pockets. And the only reason they didn't kill him is they probably thought he was going to die anyway. But it's one of those where if the gooks wanted you, they were going to get you. And the amount of people they had to spend to kill you was immaterial to them. It just depended on how bad they wanted to make a point. That's why during late 66 and all of 67 was phase four of their idea, the North Vietnamese plan of war. We were winning the war because we were isolating the people, their main support, from them. And so they started all these big set battles out up in the mountains to draw Americans away from the people in the cities, in the towns, so that we could control them as much. And that's when Tet hit, January in 68 there. They had spent all of 67 drawing all the Marines out of Hue, out of Phu Bai, out of Dong Ha, out of all these towns way up into the mountains. And then that's when they, a lot of the times, they snuck by us. And that's when they went into Way City and did all that, and Saigon and all that. Okay. And we just kept moving closer and closer to Quezon to try to relieve the 26th Marine Regiment that was stationed there. That's where my next big, outside of all these little villages where people were being killed left and right, we stumbled into a North Vietnamese base camp. In the middle of nowhere, they had all these gorgeous steps built into the side of the mountain, but they weren't supposed to be found, and we found them. And I'll never forget, as we're walking up that hill, you could see a big anti-aircraft gun that the gooks had dragged all the way to the top of this hill, and you could see this guy on the hill. He had chained himself to this big gun, and he was just saying, "Come and get me." And so that was a whole week battle there. You know, our first squad got they set a garbage mine off, these big drums full of glass and nails and rocks. And that's when we knew we were going to get hit bad, when they set that off and killed Rawls. And right on, in one squad, they killed a guy named Rawls, and wounded Bouchard and Page and Lasoya and Ortiz and Anderson. And from there on in, it was just fight our way up the hill and killing them as we went. They were in all these big underground bunkers. And it was just a week-long fight.
What size unit was that?
Their size?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing as I was the division area, there was a thousand of them.
Mm-hmm. And what size was the Marine contingent going up?
Well, unfortunately, first they called in the 9th Marines, and they went through a couple companies of the 9th Marine Regiment, killing and wounding everybody. Then they sent India Company up, and they killed and wounded that company, and then they sent Kilo Company up, and by this time, we had killed enough of them that we fought our way to the top.
Mm-hmm.
So that was seems to be the practice of the Marines. They just keep throwing in Marine outfits, and when one got decimated, they'd pull it back and throw in another one.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of artillery, naval gunfire, and air support did you see brought in on that particular operation?
Well, we'd have Phantoms mm-hmm. come in, the jets dropping napalm and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you were always, there was the 7th Fleet off the coast, and if you were somewhat close to the coast, as we still were,
mm-hmm.
you could call in the gunfire from the destroyers and whatever guns they have on Navy ships.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to make sure your guy on the radio, your radio man, knew his job,
mm-hmm.
because when you're just looking at a map, you got to really know how to read a topographical map to call it in, so you don't call it in on top of yourself,
mm-hmm.
of which happened in various outfits.
Yeah. And with this particular operation, when you're going up against this entrenched enemy and these bunkers and whatnot, how effective was that fire support that was brought in?
Not at all, because they were dug in so deep they'd had years to dig in. And they just go back down in their holes and then come back up. So, if any good came out of it, it would drive them back into their holes for us to get closer
mm-hmm.
to individually throw hand grenades and things into the bunkers.
Mm-hmm. About how deep were their bunkers?
This one has like had a two-story underground hospital built into it.
Did you get to go down into that, or?
Not me personally, being a crew-served weapon, and being I'm not a big person, but I'm not little. That always sends the little guys down, because the tunnel rats could get in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, with something like that, they'd always call in our intelligence people to do whatever they did to by seeing how many beds and all that stuff an intelligent guy learns to look for to determine size of the enemy.
Mm-hmm. No,
and of course,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
One thing with the Marines, a lot of people don't know is you had to be wounded 3 times before they'd let you come home.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was just a tiny little scratch, so to speak, you didn't get to go home. And after every firefight, if a guy got wounded, he'd always call out, "Hey, number one, or number two, I only got 2 more Purple Hearts to go." I mean, we had guys being sent back in the Marines with, like Bouchard, that got shot in the chest, and he came back out into the field with stitches still. They hadn't even taken the stitches out of his chest yet, because we were so short of people.
Mm-hmm. Was he truly ready for combat again?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, he still had pus oozing out of his wounds. But they didn't care. They just sent your ass back out there because we were so shorter. Tetris 68, everybody was getting killed so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the system, the draft system or the whatever system they had in America, weren't prepared for this, so they couldn't shove enough people through fast enough to get his replacements.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they thought, well, we'll just make sure you got to have to be wounded 3 times before you can come home.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't bad enough.
Yeah. And with... Since you were on a crew-served weapon, that rocket, the bazooka, what did you do for that particular operation coming up against guys that were obviously in...
Well, that's where the rockets were good, because you could see a hole by now,
mm-hmm.
The area around their bunkers would be blasted clean
mm-hmm.
from mortar fire or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And these 3.5 rockets could go through 11 inches of steel, the hardest steel known to man at that time. Because they were basically supposed to be used for tanks,
mm.
in case the Chinese or whatever came across.
Mm-hmm.
But they worked great for going into bunkers, because they could bury themselves in the ground before they'd go off.
Mm.
You just load shoot it. Attacks get closer and closer.
Mm-hmm. Would you use it to take out, like that, you mentioned an anti-aircraft gunner sitting on the side of a hill?
They didn't use it to take him out. They just finally, by the time we fought our way to the top, we were all out.
Oh.
We were all out of rockets, and so they just shot him.
Okay.
He tried to surrender, but after a week of making us fight our way all the way up the hill, I don't even remember who did it, but when he raised his hands up, we just said, fuck you, and shot him.
Mm-hmm. Was it, now, was this a quad 50, or?
No, it's one of those great big ones like they have on ships to shoot down airplanes.
And oh, okay.
Those big ones you see where the two barrels go back and forth, like 40 millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I mean, that's the one thing about the North Vietnamese. And they drag. They're tough little sons of guns. They could drag anything up there.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere.
Yeah. And he was using that to fire down on you guys
mm-hmm.
when coming up?
Yeah, it was cutting down trees. I'll never forget that. Big trees were being cut down. Cause this was a 40 millimeter, not even supposed to be used for people. It's supposed to be used, like, to shoot down airplanes going
mm-hmm.
up over North Vietnam.
Yeah.
They dragged that all the way down there.
Well, and the air support that you guys brought in couldn't take him out?
That's something people don't understand. Being in the Marines, you didn't have a lot of support. I mean, I'll never forget an Army guy came on once, and he was plotting fires in case we got hit at night. And our Marine FO went over and went, what the hell are you doing? And he said, well, I'm plotting. And he says, we don't have that money. He says, we're only allowed X number of shells a day, and you just shot them all up. Now if we get hit tonight, they're not going to send us any, let us have any shells. And so very rarely you'd get... Number one, you'd always try to get air support, but the Marine Corps being so small and supporting only the Marines, usually, unless, you know, it was a big, big battle, you know, they never got any air support on that one. And, you got some ground fire, but, or naval fire, but it just didn't seem to
mm-hmm.
take him out.
Hmm. So for that operation, you really didn't get that much air support?
No.
Okay.
None whatsoever. It was just us crawling up there, crawling and shooting and taking casualties and finally getting
mm-hmm.
to the top.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big hill.
Okay. Did your attitude about the war change over time?
About this time of, this was called Hill 512 outside of Khe Sanh where this big battle took place. And by now I'd been there, this was May 9th. And, my attitude hadn't changed about the war. I just found myself, well, hating
mm-hmm.
North Vietnamese more and more.
Mm-hmm.
I was, after about 4 or 5 months, you get into the full swing of really anger of seeing all your buddies dead, no legs and arms, and all you want to do is kill, kill, kill.
Mm-hmm.
But I really didn't ever question, hey, we shouldn't be here and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That attitude, from what I read, didn't seem to come in till the summer of 69 onward.
Mm-hmm.
And by 70, like I'm just reading a book now by this Keith William Nolan, who's one of the most excellent writers of the Vietnam War. He's got about 8 books out. And I keep reading his books. He does books on different outfits. I'm like, the one I'm reading now is about 1970. And I go, holy shit, thank God I wasn't there then. Because everybody knew the war was lost, is what they say. But by 68, the elections were still far off. And this was May, and the elections weren't going to be till September, and we just thought, well, there's no way that we are not going to win this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't really changed my attitude towards the war.
Mm-hmm.
Just I found myself getting more cynical about God and things like that.
Mm. And did that remain constant, that kind of cynicism?
Yep, it remained all the way until January 69 when I got wounded the second time. So all the way through there, and it just hate.
Mm-hmm.
We got wiped out so bad then on Hill 512 in May of 68, they brought us back down outside of Da Nang, which for the Marines was pretty much the furthest point south to give us a little, where we needed so many replacements.
Mm-hmm.
They sent us out to the High Dai Lac Pass where we refitted and regrouped and,
mm-hmm.
and then started more operations.
Mm-hmm. Now, in these various areas where you were conducting your operations, were there a lot of booby traps and stuff?
Up north, there were no booby traps whatsoever, because it was all North Vietnamese. They didn't need that. Booby traps were more around secure areas where the North Vietnamese could not attack you in force, but they would have the local Viet Cong go out at night and plant landmines and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And still, when they brought us down to Da Nang, they sent us out 30, 40 miles west of Da Nang to a little village called Thong Duc. And we ran patrols, and we were still far enough out to where when we did take casualties, it was gunshot. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the following January 69 when they sent Kilo Company down to what we called the Arizona that was nothing but booby traps. And that's what screwed us up so much, because we were going through an area waiting to be hit, and we started losing 3 people a day to booby traps who we didn't know what to look for. Mm. That was still 6-7 months away after Thong Duc. Mm-hmm. Yep, June, July, August of 68, Thong Duc there was a Green Beret outpost that we pretty much protected. We'd run patrols up into the hills. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a safe area. The people along the river there liked us, would sell us bottles of Coke for $1 apiece, steal our sea rations or things of that nature. That was the first time we worked with the Arvin outfit. It was the last time, thank God.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of... You mentioned that when you did finally encounter a significant number of booby traps, you really weren't all that well prepared for that. What kind of training, in-country training or briefings and that kind of stuff, had you received?
None. Okay. None whatsoever. They just sent us down into the Arizona at 6 o'clock on a Friday night, and by 12, moving to a certain destination, we had lost 3 guys. And then the next day, sweeping this area, we lost 3 more. And every day after that, we lost 3. And when I go to reunions now, you see people with no legs, and you go, hey, where are we at? They always say the same thing. The Arizona, Anwa. That was southwest of Da Nang. That whole area, there were no North Vietnamese whatsoever, but the people still hated us so bad they'd plant booby traps. That was what was frustrating. You'd never see the enemy to shoot them, but you'd just suffer all these casualties. That's why I was glad I was in a crew served weapon. I never had to walk point. In June of 68, they took rockets away from us because they had, A, developed the Law, which was a kind of like a rocket bazooka thing. You'd pull it apart, and it was a one-shot deal. And because we were not keeping up with the enlistments at that time, when they took away rockets from the Marine Corps, all of a sudden, all through the Marine Corps, you had 3-man teams that you could phase into machine gunners, radio men, mm-hmm. infantry.
And that's when you phased into being a machine gunner?
Yes.
At what point, what time period was this?
This would be the summer of 68.
Summer of 68.
June.
Now, how about wildlife? Were there any problems with animals of any kind, or insects?
Up north in the mountains, the only problem was not for your safety, but to scare the hell out of you. Way up in the mountains around Quezon, like on Hill 512 and all that, it was really gorgeous, really pretty country, and big mountains with waterfalls coming out the side of them and stuff, but there was rock apes. And these rock apes would come up your lines at night because they were curious, and they'd throw rocks at us. Mm. And we thought it was the Dukes, so everybody would be all scared and staying up all night. But outside, there was a few units that I heard and read about. Some tigers killed some Marines. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, you'd worry pretty much about snakes, mm-hmm. centipedes. They had these big centipedes that were about a foot long. And boy, if they'd bite you, wouldn't kill you, but it'd make you so sick you'd have to be medevaced to a hospital.
Did that happen to anybody in your unit?
It's funny you should say that, because I remember we were at Thong Duc. We took over these old trenches that the previous Marine outfit had been in, and redoing the sandbags. A big one came out, and I remember him crawling across my foot, and I kept jiggling my foot, going, bite me, get me out of here. and he wouldn't. So I just stepped on him. And one of the biggest things, outside of... enemy action, though, that got us all was malaria just decimated us. Mm-hmm. I got malaria on 5/12 to where I didn't even see the last 2 to 3 days because I was starting to wander around in a daze. So they sent me, got me out of the bush, put me on the hospital ship USS Sanctuary, stabled my condition, along with a bunch of other guys from various outfits through Vietnam, because malaria was so prevalent that, because you're always drinking out of the paddies and the streams and the mosquitoes, and there's 5 stages of malaria, and they got me in the second stage, which is good, so I spent a month between USS Sanctuary and Cameron Bay. Was a great big army base way down by Saigon, and where you'd go to recover and send you back. Whereas if they didn't get you out of the field right away, malaria really could kill you. But that was a biggie, malaria. But see, once again, because of the time frame, that's another thing. Army, Navy, Air Force spent 12 months in Vietnam. Marines had to spend 12, a whole year and an extra month, so they'd get that extra month out of you. And you quickly learn that if you make it 365 days, so to speak, you can come home. So if you can get out of the field with a Purple Heart or malaria and get sent back to the rear, all that's fine and well because that counts on your time. And so when the Navy corpsman would come around with the little orange malaria pills, it got so bad that everybody wanted to get malaria and get out of the bush just for a few days that we wouldn't take them. You'd put them in your mouth, and finally the officers had to make sure that the corpsman would put them in your mouth and he'd physically watch you swallow them.
Was that common in your unit?
It was common in every unit. If you can do anything, anything you can do legally, I mean not shoot yourself, but you get malaria or you break your leg, get sent back to the rear, great.
Get bit by centipede?
I saw guys jump off, one guy jumped off a 30-foot cliff just to break his leg, because he just couldn't take it. He broke his leg, sent him away, or a lot of the, whatever you could do to get out of the bush was accepted, short of shooting yourself, which would be dishonorable and stuff like that. But, hey, you somehow got hurt, hey, that's okay. Might live instead of be killed. And, of course, in April of 68, with Martin Luther King being killed, and, of course, you always had to worry about the blacks, massive fights everywhere.
And even out in the field?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you were a white squad leader, you made the blacks walk point, and vice versa. And the blacks always wanted to be together, and fights all the time. I'll never forget one right on Route 9 before we went uphill 512. This new black came over. Him and one of the squad leaders that had been there a year got into it right in the middle of on patrol. Everybody just sat down and watched them fight it out.
What was the fight of them?
The animosity of the blacks at that time towards the whites being told what to do. And this guy was simply a squad leader saying, he said, Corporal Lewis, get your men on the lawn. Let's go. We got to go on patrol here. And he wasn't moving fast enough, so we just came over and started front beating him up. And, of course, the rear was a whole other story. All the blacks, the minute you got anywhere near the rear, the blacks hung together and the whites hung together. Never talked.
But I'm curious, out in the field, this fight, well, I guess...
Right in the middle of the jungle.
Right in the middle of the jungle, yep. you're about to assault this Hill 512, which is this major entrenched NVA regiment.
Correct.
And, here's the squad leader fighting with, the team leader.
Yep.
In the squad.
Yep. That happened all the time.
Yeah. What was the response of your first sergeant? What was the response of your platoon leader?
Well, they were all back in the... we were so short of people at this time. This was just a 15-man squad-sized patrol. We just had Corporal Mansky, who was in charge of this. I mean, the staff sergeant and the platoon, and the lieutenant from the first platoon, they were, back X number of... just a little ways back, because he was trying to control all the squads. We just had this little 15-man squad that was going to start to go up this hill. So everybody just sat down, watched them fight.
How long did it last?
Oh, not very long because the black guy had just come over from the States and the white guy had been humping the bush for a year. And he, you know, if you do that for a year, you're in shape.
Mm-hmm.
Your stamina, so he just beat the piss out of him. And
so the squad leader won?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And was there, from that point on, was there just an understanding that the team leader would do what he was told, or was there constant friction?
Constant friction.
Any threats of, or attempts of fragging?
Fragging was pretty much in the rear. What you would do in that situation is if you had troublemakers, you see, when you set in at night, you always put three men out in front of your lines, a listening post, in case you get hit. They're supposed to throw some hand grenades and run back to the main outfit to say, here they come, here they come. And usually you'd give them a Claymore Maya, half-moon-shaped mm-hmm. thing that would send out all those ball bearings.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can take them apart, and in the back of the ball bearings is a plastic explosive called C4, and you can take that out so that when the gooks had hit the blacks sitting in their little hole, they'd pop this Claymore, which would hopefully kill a bunch of North Vietnamese and allow them to run back. But with no explosive in there, the blasting cap would just go pop, and they wouldn't end it. It was stuff like that all the time.
So the people on
killed.
The point, the
they'd
people out there in the observation post would be given faulty Claymores?
Correct.
Purposefully?
Yeah. Yep. There was a lot of big time heat there, right about Martin Luther King being killed. It was started to really deteriorate.
Wow.
I mean, I remember going back to when they took us down to Da Nang, they let us go to a place called Freedom Hill,
mm-hmm.
which was a PX and a movie theater and some guy making hamburgers trying to make you feel like home. I'd see guys I went through training with, and I'd go, hey, so-and-so, and they'd just turn their back on you and walk away. Get the fuck out of here, Whitey. It was a whole different ball game in the rear. The blacks stayed with the blacks, and the whites stayed with the whites.
Hmm.
Fights all the time. Hmm. Fights all the time.
Hmm. Well, how much time did you spend in the rear?
Well, when they, after 5/12, and we were so wiped out, they brought us down to Dailac Pass for a couple weeks before they sent us to Thong Duc. And then, after running patrols and operations June, July, August, after August 21st, where I got my first Purple Heart, we got hit at Thong Duc and had a whole bunch of dead and wounded. They brought us back, and for some reason, the next 3 months of my tour were great. September, October, November, we had been suffering so many casualties from this, they made us security, so to speak, for Da Nang. If there was anywhere that we'd go out into the villages on the outskirts of Da Nang and set up, but it was so peaceful and secure that, God, it was the just best 3 months. All we did is come back and we're set up at night in these villages. We all of us that had been there since the previous January knew we weren't going to get hit here. So, but just in case they hit Da Nang, they'd have various outfits, Army, Marine, whatever, at various parts of Da Nang protecting the big city. So we stayed there until January 69 when they sent us to the Arizona. We knew our party time was over.
Yeah. Now, when you were at, is it Long Duck or Thong Duck?
Thong Duck.
That was where the Special Forces camp was?
Yes. God, we hated them.
Why?
Overlooking this village was two hills, two small hills like two tits on a woman. Mm-hmm. The Green Beret had one hill with triple concertina wire and a club with pop and beer. And on the other little tit, there was just the Marines with nothing, just holes in the ground. And they wouldn't even sell us pop. They wouldn't, not only would they not give us pop, but they wouldn't even sell us pop and beer. You know, they did a stay inside their little compound and party down while the Marines were outside running patrols up into the hills. And then August 21st, when we got hit, just this last reunion here, just this last August, we still talk about all the guys that survived that little battle, talk about it, how, man, we were inside their landing zone when we got hit. And me and my friend, right off the bat, we had five dead, a bunch of us wounded. And me and my buddy went to the underground hospital and said, hey, we're getting hit out here, we need help. And they looked at us and said, you're Marines, wait, you can help yourself, you take care of yourself, we're not coming out there. Man, we Never forget that. We were all going to go back and kill every one of them until one of the sergeants saw us going down there with our guns, and he goes, look, that's murder. You can't be shooting your own. We said, yeah, but Sarge, you saw what they did. They won't even come on. He says, I know, but that's just the way it is. And so we left that hill. Just hated the Army. Every time we worked with the Army, we just hated them because they weren't trained like we were. They had all this artillery. They had all this firepower. We had nothing. I mean, we couldn't wait till the firefights to take the simple backpacks off the dead North Vietnamese because theirs was better than the Marines. When I got to Okinawa in January of 68, thinking it was all brand new World War II stuff. They were just pieces of shit.
Mm-hmm.
The Army had all the latest, you know. And of course, there was that animosity between Marine and Army.
Mm-hmm.
They had a shorter time period. They always had food. Sometimes we'd have to go 2-3 days without food because we just didn't have the supply system they did.
Smaller. Mm-hmm. How would you get resupply, typically?
Most of the time from choppers.
Okay.
Depending on how bad an area you were in, mm-hmm. they'd either A, land, or if you didn't have bad enough casualties to take out, make it last. To be pulled back to a safer area, they just fly over our area and throw it out the door in the back.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And while you were at Thong Duc, now, Special Forces camps typically were in an area where there was a village or rough puffs, whatever. Did you, when you were there engaged in operations in that area, were the Special Forces, regional force, popular force units out there working as well, or were they just staying back?
No, they just kind of hung around.
Yeah.
They just stayed back in their little area.
Mm-hmm. Now
they had the Marines go out and do all their work for them. So.
Okay. And what about while you were in that area, the ability of the Special Forces camp or the Special Forces personnel to bring in fire support?
They had all that. They had everything they wanted.
But they didn't bring it in support of your operation?
No. That was one thing that made us so mad. Being up in the hills and looking down on this, they're triple Constantino wire and their clubs and underground hospitals. And just fostered hate.
Mm.
I mean, you'd go back to the rear. I remember coming back off an operation by some Army base. They wouldn't even let us come inside their compound and sleep on the ground. Because, they knew what we were going to do. We were going to steal them blind and beat them up. That was the big thing. You go to an Army base, it was, even the officers, you steal anything you can from the Army.
Hmm. And that was the mentality and the attitude the entire time you were in Vietnam?
Correct. Oh. It's like when we were security for Da Nang there, mm-hmm. they took us down to China Beach.
Mm-hmm.
For a USO show, this band from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget that. He goes, I see we're represented by all the services today. The Navy, and a few of the Navy guys, and the Army, and the Marines. And one guy stands up, 101st Airborne. And my buddy just knocked him right off the bleachers and started a big fight. I had to call the MPs, and we just hated him. Just hated him.
Mm-hmm. This USO show, was that the only one you saw?
When we were at First Tanks, they'd bring them in every now and then. Whether it's some little band from Australia, or there were some bands from back in the States that they'd set up on some makeshift stage and play rock and roll music and
mm-hmm.
make you think you're back home. All it did is piss you off, because you usually had female singers, and they're out of your reach, so it just piss you off.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the Bob Hope show they took us to.
Mm-hmm. Where did you see Bob Hope?
Da Nang. He comes out with Ann Margaret, and at that time, the gold diggers,
uh-huh.
and all, and that's what everybody thought was, I don't want to see this, unless I can have it. And you couldn't, so it just pissed you off.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is somewhat different from some of the attitudes about USO shows that I've heard in the past. So if you had a choice, you probably would not have, you would have preferred not to have seen this?
Me, just me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to see him.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, hey, I'm not over here to see you at socials. I thought we were over here to... This was the start of my way. How can you guys be doing this? Aren't we supposed to be just killing the goobs? Why are we not out there doing this? Mm. That's when you finally, started to creep into my mind that this was after the elections now in the fall of 68.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, geez. Well, all we started to do is saw us starting to go over the same old ground, and why aren't we going to North Vietnam? Why aren't we going into Laos? Why aren't we going into Cambodia? Well, we can't do that. Well, why? There was just all these questions of, I don't understand this.
Mm-hmm.
And at the age of 18 and a half, I'm going, I just don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we attacking North Vietnam? Why? I mean, nobody had the answers, but because
mm-hmm.
we all wondered the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand these rules, chase them to the DMZ and stop, chase them to the Laotian border and stop, or when you got close enough to Da Nang or a bigger city, but when you'd get ambushed, Christ, before you could fire back, you'd have to call on the radios, call back and see now, are there any Korean Marines in the area? Are there any South Vietnamese, are there any other Marine or Army outfits? Is this really the, it was just stupid. And that's what pissed us off.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it started to creep in. What the heck here? I don't get this. I don't understand why we're not attacking. All these rules started to come into effect that I hadn't paid attention to before.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much had the rules of engagement been discussed with you as a member of this unit, and what did you think of the rules of engagement?
Oh, when we were up north, that there were no. You just went on search and destroys, and when you ran into the enemy, you just killed everybody and moved on. And that was, the rules of engagement changed the more you got to populated areas. You didn't know who was around there.
And what were the rules?
Of course, we had rules. Well, we worked with the Korean Marines a couple times, and they didn't have any rules. We'd go into a village and say, any VC or NVE or no VC. Okay, move on. The Koreans would bring in, they weren't under the Geneva Convention for some reason. They'd bring 10 people over and shoot all 10 of them dead and go, where's the VC? Well, no VC. They'd shoot 10 more. And finally, somebody would go, well, they're over there. And they could do that. I don't know why.
So the Koreans would kill civilians?
Oh, yeah. They'd kill the civilians. They'd kill the enemy. They'd kill themselves. One time they were taking a hill, and the North Vietnamese were going down the other side running away, and they were so pissed off, they called in artillery and air support right on top of themselves. They didn't care if they got killed, they just wanted to kill the North Vietnamese.
Well,
yeah, they were something to work with. I don't know if it was an Oriental thing where, the Japs hate the Koreans or the Koreans hate the Chinese or whatever, but boy, those Koreans, they did not like Vietnamese. And plus, from going to Vietnam, they got paid the same salary as Americans. That was the big incentive for the Koreans to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in their army, they didn't get paid shit. But when they worked with us, they got paid the same as we did.
Mm-hmm. Did you work with any other country forces?
Nope. Just the Koreans a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnamese once.
How did that go? Where was that? What was the operation?
Oh, that was out at Dong Duc.
Okay.
And we were going to be a blocking force on one side of this area,
mm-hmm.
and the Vietnamese were going to push through the area, sweeping the area, pushing any North Vietnamese into us.
Mm-hmm.
And as we're waiting, we hear all this gunfire, and oh man, we thought, oh my God, they're pushing the entire North Vietnamese army towards us, and here they come out through the woods, shooting birds and just shooting into the air because they were letting the North Vietnamese know, here we come, run away, so we don't got to fight you.
Mm.
God, that made us so mad. We thought, boy, they were pushing who knows what towards us. And then they just come strolling through the woods, shooting birds and animals and stuff, and we're going, we need some bitches. Now, I have heard from other people, of course, there were some good Vietnamese outfits, but I never saw any. All the ones I saw were, they've been fighting for all these years, and they were going to keep fighting after we left, so they figured, why push it?
Okay. And what about other enemy units that you encountered, whether they were Vietnamese or from other countries?
Just North Vietnamese, except the Chinese advisors. When we were up north, after a firefight, you'd always find some Chinese in them. You could tell by their uniform and the letter and the papers they had on. Mm-hmm. They were sending Chinese down. Plus, these guys were all over 6 feet high, and there was no Vietnamese that were that tall.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see any, but other guys saw various Caucasian, what we figured was like East Germans or Russians.
Mm-hmm.
They'd capture a few of them. We never did, but I heard about it.
Mm-hmm. How about actual fighting units, not advisors, but you know, when you'd go in and you'd find these large, perhaps a large number of people from another country that were actually fighting
for the North
alongside, you know,
yep,
alongside
the Chinese mostly.
But what? How about how many Chinese would you find?
Oh, gosh, I don't know how to answer that one. I mean, in my small scope, I suppose that somebody higher up the rank chain would know, but I mean, I remember going through these one bodies, and one guy goes, "Hey, look at these guys." We went over there, and there was about five or six of them laying there, all dead. They'd been around this one cruiser, weapon on wheels, this big machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had just that little bit of different uniform. We started going through their pockets, and then we had some interpreters with us, and they said, "God, all these letters are going back to China."
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then, of course, intelligence would come along and scoop all that stuff up, and that's the last we ever heard of it.
Mm-hmm. And why don't you go ahead and discuss in a little bit more detail that action which resulted in you being wounded?
The first or second time?
Both.
The first time, the Song Duck, and we'd been running operations around this Greenberry outpost, and they were pulling us out to bring another Marine outfit in to give them a little time doing whatever. And as we were standing inside the compound, the choppers were sitting there, and we couldn't hear nothing. And I remember looking at my squad leader's face, Sergeant Renshaw's, and all of a sudden his eyes got real big, and I went, "Oh, I wonder what his problem is." And I turned around and saw this ball of smoke rising from the ground, and immediately from the being having 8 months in the bush by then, I knew we were getting hit with incoming. Well, that one round had landed right next to the second squad, killed six people, and gave me a tiny little sting in my leg, which, like I say, the first thing I did was when I jumped in the trench, I went, "All right, one down, two more to go." And then this Indian came around, and he goes, "We got dead and wounded out here, you guys, come on." And that's when we went out, and the choppers immediately took off, and that was the one time the Army called in airstrikes to silence this recoilless rifle that was shooting at us. Give us time to get our dead and wounded on the choppers and leave. And that was the first time. Second time, we were in Arizona, and once again, sweeping this area. It was all booby traps. We've been losing people every day, and as we went through this one area, the machine gun team leader by this time, having had almost a year overseas, a good buddy of mine from Philadelphia said, "Hey, Spider-Man." And that was my nickname. We all had nicknames. And I thought, "Oh, to hell with Lieutenant." I talked to my buddy, and I stopped. And my ammo humper kept going and tripped a booby trap. Killed him, and the guy I was talking to killed him, and another guy that came over on the plane with me, Jimmy Porter from Kansas, he got killed. And I was wounded, and Paul Misch was wounded. The only thing that saved me is I had taken my M60 machine gun off, and we had leaned it against my leg to talk to my friend here when the explosion occurred, and that took most of the blast and broke my legs. And I remember laying there. It was such a bad area. When they got us on the chopper and got us out of there, I remember waiting at Naval Support Activity Da Nang Hospital, and I looked up, and here's another guy from my outfit. And I said, What are you doing here? He said, "We no more and got all you guys dead and wounded on the chopper. We got online and moved out and tripped another one." So it was just, nobody knew what to really look for. They didn't give us any training on booby. We had no idea what to look for. And of course the Vietnamese had years of practice at camouflage, so they were hiding it real good. And then that was January 21st, 1969, and I still had, I had about 12 days left when I got hit. It was bad enough where they sent me to, had a couple operations there in Da Nang. They sent me to Guam. I had a couple operations, and then up to Japan, and then over to Alaska, and down the Great Lakes. They tried to give you, put you in a hospital closest to your home so your parents could come see you. They put me in Great Lakes Naval Hospital outside of Chicago.
And what was the nature of your wounds, besides the broken legs?
They blew my calf off, and I got big hunks out of both my legs, and this is where I suppose your, I don't know if you call it faith or fate, but like the guy I was talking to, when he goes, "Hey, how's it going, Spider?" I took my machine gun off my leg and rested it against there, and I had taken my helmet off and was wiping my forehead because it was warm out. And I was about to complain how hot it was when the explosion went off, and not only did I get it in the legs, but my right arm that was wiping off my forehead, I got shrapnel all along my forearm, and the guy I was talking to right next to me, he got it in the head. So, you know, you start to, and this is where I, like I say, this had been a year, and I distinctly remember laying there looking up and saying to the sky, "Okay, God, if there really is a God, you'll let me keep my legs. We'll see, won't we?" And it was the oddest thing. It's hard to explain. This big hand came down out of the sky, put itself on my chest, and just like that, I knew I was going to be okay. And it was like, wow, there is a God. I'll never forget that. Because I'd kind of stopped believing after seeing all this death and destruction and putting all these people in body bags and seeing little kids ripped apart by, you know, that was the hard part, seeing the little kids that would be hurt, shot, wounded, little arms and legs dangling, and dead babies and shit. I started to really become cynical, like, well, there can't be a God because God wouldn't let this happen.
But your faith was...
Instantly I went, wow! I mean, it's very hard to explain how all of a sudden when that hand came down and put itself on my chest that I immediately knew I was going to keep both my legs. That's what I said. I said, okay, if there is a God, you'll let him prove it to me. If I keep my legs, I'll always believe. Of course, the bravest thing I ever did was that when I was laying there, I knew what would happen, and I'm listening to Wiley over here, he's the one who tripped it. He had his legs blown off, and he's laying there screaming. And I look over at Gallagher, and he ain't got no head. And I thought, well, let's see. I know I'm wounded. I know I'm wounded in the legs, but what about my... And as being a male, I thought, oh, God, what about my penis? And I thought, well, I better check it out. Well, what happens if it's gone? I know I'll go into shock. What happens? You know, so the bravest thing I've always said the bravest thing I ever did was take my hand and check out my nuts. And when they were there and I felt them, I went, fuck it, I don't care if I lose my legs.
Okay.
I'll never forget that. But I remember laying there, and it was really weird. The shrapnel had sliced across my thumb like a surgeon's knife. And I remember it had sliced it right down to the joint of my right thumb, but didn't take my thumb off. And I remember moving my thumb with this piece of flap, which was the rest of the thumb hanging there. And I went, God, that looks just like a chicken bone. I'm thinking that. Then they shot me up with morphine, and before the pain reached me. Then I didn't feel any pain until I was laying at the hospital, and they jerked they tried to get all your clothes off real fast, and he jerked my boot off my broken leg. That woke me up. That brought the pain in, and they went, oh, and I'll never forget the doctor looking at me and going, well, I guess his leg's broke.
Ouch.
And there was a big long hallway with all these Marines from different outfits just laying there, and the surgeons were just, there was like three or four rooms, and they were just working, and as your time came, they just moved you closer to one of these rooms. Another thing I remember, usually before the mask came down over my head, you know, they were going, okay, count 10, 9, 8, and you'll be out. For some reason, my surgeon went, he says, "Let's say the Lord's Prayer here." And I kind of went, wow, this is really odd as I'm going out. time, this was 2 days later, I woke up still at Da Nang Hospital, and some of the cadet brought our outfit back in out of the bush and replaced it with some 3rd Marine Regiment guys, and they came to see me, and they were saying, oh, man, you know, telling everybody who's dead and wounded. And what really stuck in my mind is Jimmy Porter being killed, because out of Kilo Company that I knew of, him and I were the last guys left out of that plane load that came over the previous January. There was no other guys left but me and Jimmy Porter. Out of a whole 747 of people that I came over with that I knew of, everybody else had been dead and wounded. That's why I kind of thought I had it made there, getting so close.
What did you think of the medical care you received in country and then after?
Oh, excellent. But great doctors, you know, caring, and of course they had tons of experience. And from Japan, they put me in a body cast, plaster body cast from my neck down to stabilize me for the long flight, just kept me doped up on morphine until I got to Great Lakes Naval Hospital. And I vaguely remember them ripping that off, and they were, took a week to get back. And I remember all these bandages that stuck to my war wounds. Man, they were ripping these off, and I was just screaming until they, I don't know what it was, but they gave me some little tube, and they said, suck on this, and I did. It was obviously some kind of narcotic, because the next thing I know, I'm just sitting up on the bed. You know, you boys need any help, let me know. Watching them take a drill and drill through the tibia, the bone below the knee, they drill a hole through that and then insert this metal pin for traction to keep your legs straight. But they couldn't, they had to do that because I had so many open wounds that I had just had to lay in the bed like that for a while. At Great Lakes, like Ward 3 South, there was 20 guys in a row, and across from them there was 20 guys, and then a big wall partition, and on the other side was another 20 guys, and then 20 guys across from that bed. So just all of us with various wounds. You know, I wish I'd had taken a movie camera and recorded the odd stories of how everybody around me from different Marine and Army units had been wounded. Because, you know, some of them were just so odd.
Okay. Well, I'm curious. It's going to seem like an odd question, but when you were in Da Nang and you woke up the first time after being in the hospital, what were you wearing? And they had taken your uniform and stuff off. What did they put you in?
Nothing.
Oh, so you were naked?
Yep.
Okay, no surgical gown or anything like
that? No.
Okay.
That way they could get at my wounds instantly.
Okay.
Now, remember that's another thing that, you know, little snatches come back to me, have come back to me of, like, I remember all my veins collapsed because I was so close to the blast, and I remember them telling me to make a big space with my neck so they could find the vein in my neck to stick this tube in. I remember that. And then I kept drifting in and out and woke up with some of my buddies coming back to me. Like, we had one guy that stayed in the rear because way the previous March he had got shot in the head and didn't kill him, but they sent him back out to the bush after he got better. But he was starting to go blind. And it was really weird because until we went to the lieutenant and said, look, we can't have this guy coming out into the bush. He's going to get us killed. He's going blind. I mean, we'd have to lead him around on patrol with his hand, grab his hand. But we just needed people so bad they kept sending him back out because he was only going blind at night. You know, he could kind of see in the daytime. I'll never forget that, too. At least Schmitty made it. Now he's totally blind.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, what did, you were in the hospital here in the States for about 9 months, is that correct?
I got wounded January 21st, and by February 2nd, I was at Great Lakes Naval Hospital and progressed from my broken leg being good enough, and my war wound healing with scabs enough to where they could put me in a body cast, and they sent me home for 2 months, where I just laid around the house, and had everybody look at you like you're a freak, you know. You come back home, and you can tell people aren't really used to seeing, you know, mangled up bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there until October 15th, and then they transferred me up to the Minneapolis Veterans Hospital. Stayed there a little bit until I got discharged, and then they just medically retired me because of my war wounds, and took a few more operations with getting shrapnel out of my legs and stuff later on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, out there February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September. October 15th, I came home.
For good?
Yep.
Okay. What did you think about how the war wound down in terms of Vietnamization, the...
Anger. Yeah. When I saw that, you know, by then, now we're going into 1970, the Cambodian incursion, the Laos, Lamson, I'm going, why weren't we doing this? Oh, anger. I just couldn't believe my country was going to let this war end this way.
Mm-hmm.
And just anger at, anger at my country, anger at the people, how they treated me around, treated me when I came back home, you know, tried to join the VFW, and, we don't want you Vietnam vets in here. Things like that, or I remember dating this one girl, I'm home, and I finally could walk with crutches, and my legs were in two casts. I'll never forget dating an old, taking an old girlfriend out to eat, and when we got back to her house, I was going to kiss her goodnight, and the next time I called her, she goes, oh, we can't be doing that around here. My mom says, you know, you're just a Vietnam vet, you'll never amount to nothing, so I really can't see anymore. You know, stuff like that from everybody. And the mood of, you know, I went and talked to a few high schools, and the constant, you know, it was really the anti-war movement had finally hit the Midwest to where nobody wanted to go in.
Mm.
And it was, well, what for? We're not supposed to be there. We're not going to win. And I was struggling with myself of, on one hand, yeah, but this is America. This is, you know, to where... God, you know, it just pained me to say, well, they're right. They wouldn't let us win and stuff. So, just anger.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I got my first job. My uncle, who was a World War II, my mom, my mother's sister had a husband in World War II, and he's an orthodontic, and he gave me a job, and I had a good support system that way within the family. Not like some of the other people. Like the guy who runs the prosthetics department at the Minneapolis VA said, he came home with no leg and no arm, and his dad said, what are you bitching for? That ain't even a war over there. I'm going, wow, your own dad? He goes, yep.
Wow.
I went, wow. I mean, here the World War II, that's what we tried to emulate, hated us. That ain't a war. And then, you know, as we went into the 70s and you lost, it got worse. Everybody hated you. You know, I went to the community college, and the guy in charge of the GI Bill for us veterans to get our money wouldn't send the paperwork in, so you wouldn't get your crummy $135 a month. And it was just the women didn't want to date you because you were a baby killer. Man, all those early 70s years were just 71, 2, up all the way to 76, 77. It was just, and it got worse, of course, April 75 when.
Mm-hmm.
We got, you know, when we disgracefully left on Vietnam, and I in my own mind, my other Marine buddies, I can't believe it. I can't believe we're not going back there to win. And how can they do this? And there was just such confusion of my patriotism was, how can they do this?
Mm-hmm.
And so anger. You started going through, you know, all of us divorced from our... You know, you tried to get married and have kids and fit back in, but nobody wanted to hire you at jobs. And the women, they couldn't understand that our anger and rage, and so all of us got divorced. That's what led me to go to Africa.
Led you to where?
You know, that one picture I sent you in the book, you know, about 76, 77. After my first divorce, I still had all this anger in me, and I went to... started reading this magazine called Soldier Fortune, and they started saying, talking about the war in Rhodesia and how a lot of Americans were going over there. So I thought, well, I'm going to go fight me some more commies. I got to get rid of this anger. So I jumped on an airplane, bought a ticket, went to Ferry, got off the plane, and most of the Americans that weren't wounded were joining the Army, the Rhodesian Light Infantry, because they, it's funny, they had a, being an agricultural country, had a cavalry. And all these guys were in the cavalry, like John Wayne. And I couldn't get in the Army because of my war wounds, but all the farmers, the white farmers were hiring guards because the terrorists were trying to drive them off the land to collapse the economy. So they were hiring Vietnam vets to guard the farms.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did there.
Okay. How long did you do that?
Why?
No, how long?
June of 78 until April of 79. And that's when, thanks to Jimmy Carter and Andrew Young, they gave the country back to the terrorists. See, that's another thing. I was starting to become politically aware because I saw that the Rhodesians tried to put blacks in power that they had sent to England and were educated, but for some reason our country said, no, the only people we will accept to lead the country are the terrorists. And they killed their own people more than the white man, I found, was totally immaterial. They hated each other. The tribes hated each other so bad that they were fighting. One terrorist was being supported by the Russian communists, and the other was being supported by the Chinese communists. And these two tribes, the Matabele and the Shona, were just, they'd run into each other in the bush, and they were having big, massive firefights that had nothing to do with the white government in power because it was tribes. I quickly found out, tribes. I got two whole photo albums of that, too. They're really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Showing me going out to work with the Rhodesian African Rifles in all black outfits. Now, there was only me and one other guy from California. And that's when I knew it wasn't a white-black thing. It was a capitalist versus communist thing. Because these guys were all fighting for the government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stability and good paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. Just stayed on the farm. It was a 16,000-acre farm, and we, in the daytime, would check fences and protect the black workers that were working for the farmer, and at night put a bunch of cows in the middle of a field and then set up an ambush in case they tried to come steal cows.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. And then when they gave the country their independence, all the whites just came home. All of the Americans came home.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, how has your attitude and how do you think the American people's attitude has changed towards Vietnam veterans in more recent years?
After the Gulf War, that really, when all those guys came back and had their parades, that made so many of us angry all over again that we started getting more vocal about it, to where all of a sudden, it seems to me all of a sudden, the American people went, well, they're right, you know. It wasn't the soldier's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam wasn't the fighting man's fault. Why, it seems to be a national guilt to where all of a sudden everybody likes us. You know, it was like, I never forget, I was working at the post office carrying mail on my crippled up legs, because at least the government hired me. But I'll never forget this one lady, she goes, thank you for, let's see, she knew I was a Vietnam vet. I had shorts on. She goes, oh, whatever, I was in Vietnam. She goes, well, thank you for fighting for my country. Why? Shoot. I'll never forget. I just kind of stumbled down the street going, my first thought was, what does she want? Nobody's nice to us Vietnam vets. It's been so long since people had hated us and not wanted nothing to do with us that I was really suspicious of. And then 3 or 4 years later, somebody else did it, and I went, wow, this is really odd.
Mm-hmm.
Until finally now, within the last 5 years, it's like, I'll be somewhere in shorts, and somebody will say something. And they go, God, it's even hard to talk about it now. They'll say thank you, and I go, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't you do that in the 70s? So it's finally, it took all of the 70s and part of the 80s. There's a few of us, mostly Marines, my Marine buddies, that we thought, we will go back to Vietnam, and we will, you know, kick their ass and win. Because that's been the big stigma with the World War II vets and everybody. Oh, you lost your war. I'm going, man, we never lost it. It's one of those, We never lost a battle, but we lost the war. I mean, in fact, our ambassador, it was, you probably read that, where he is an ex-POW.
Mm-hmm.
He's our ambassador to Vietnam now, and he was at a dinner party, and he said that to one of the big high-ranking Vietnamese people. It was in our military magazine that he said, you know, you never beat us. We won every single battle. And the Vietnamese guy looked at him and said, so what? And it hit him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Well, do you have any desires to go back to Vietnam? Not to fight, I mean, but to, just
well,
to see the country?
May of 1997, I thought, you know, I'm going to go back to see where all my buddies got killed and stuff. And I went back. But the minute I got off the plane in Saigon, you know, I had no trouble going through Japan, Bangkok, Singapore. I hung around a few days in each of these cities. Just sightseeing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
No big deal with Orientals or nothing. Just another country.
Mm-hmm.
The minute I got off that plane in Saigon, it was the air and the smell that put me immediately on edge. And then going through immigration, I saw these guys in little green uniforms with their red stars on their pith helmets, and instant hate came back.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to. And the next thing I know, downtown in a hotel, and I just wanted to kill. I just wanted to strangle everybody. And I thought, boy, I got to get out of here. I can't go back up where I was fighting and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'll get so far out in the bush and I'll do something where I'll end up in prison over here.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny part was, the guy who ran the hotel I stayed in, the South Vietnamese guy, his dad was fighting with the Americans and was killed. 74.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny, whenever the people in the hotel would talk about the war, because, you know, they, all of a sudden, here's all these Americans starting to come back and stuff, but whenever they'd talk about the North, he'd lean real close to me and go, well, you know those Northerners. But no, I saw all those guys in those little green uniforms, and like one time there was at the train station there, when I was going to go up to Da Nang,
mm-hmm.
here was a troop movement of all these young kids. They didn't have guns or nothing, just a bunch of guys in the army.
Mm-hmm.
And they were young kids, weren't even born when I was over there. And I thought, God, I want to kill every single one of these people. I got to get out of here. Like, I can't go. I can't be. And it was weird. After a couple of days of holing up in my hotel room, and I even called long distance to my psychiatrist at St. Cloud Veterans Hospital. This doctor, he goes, well, I've never had a call from Saigon. I said, Doc, I can't get out of the hotel. He says, I told you not to go alone. Because I should have went with other Americans for
mm-hmm.
support.
Yeah.
But the minute I got back on that plane, the minute the wheels pulled off the ground, this anger and hate dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
Just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
I can't explain that. Mm-hmm. I still want to go back, but if I do, I want to go with a tour with a bunch of my friends.
Yeah.
Or other vets.
Yeah.
Because I thought, you know, looking at those kids, I saw myself in them. They were only 18 themselves, had no idea of the war, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this ain't right to have all this hate.
Mm-hmm.
This, and I'll never forget being over at a friend's house. His kids had some Vietnamese friends they were playing with.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the Vietnamese kids, I'll never forget this, looked at my legs and goes, what happened to your legs? I said, well, I was in the war. And he goes, what war? I said, well, the Vietnam War. And he looked up at me and he goes, oh, there was a war in Vietnam? And I went, wow, time is changing. Because
mm-hmm.
this guy's parents had, you know,
mm-hmm.
immigrated in that airlift shit.
How old was this child?
Oh, 8 or 9.
Okay.
And it was just so odd to him, like, I mean, because his parents, this was a new life. They were here in this country and they obviously never talked about the war.
Mm-hmm.
Because, hey, they were in America.
Right.
And he goes, oh, there was a war in Vietnam? And I went, wow.
Yeah.
How odd.
Well, what do you think about the current U.S. policy in normalizing relations with Vietnam?
I struggle with logic as opposed to feelings. I understand, finally, that if the war is over, and as with most, I don't know what, Army or Navy, but with most Marines, we have nothing but the utmost, deepest respect for the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
because they are hardcore fighters. Mm-hmm. If anything, we hated the South Vietnamese mm-hmm. because they were chicken shit cowards in our eyes. And I have learned to shift my hate, so to speak, or anger away from the people mm-hmm. of Vietnam to my government of the senators. I can now that I'm older, I can articulate understanding that the senators and congressmen were the ones that voted on money to South Vietnam or voted on whatever policy was brought up at that time. And so I have no anger that we're normalizing relationships. If anything, I'm angry at various members of Congress and the government back then who voted against us winning.
Okay.
Kind of like my Uncle Harry said one time, he says, I'm trying to think exactly, he says, you can hate your government. We all hate the government, but don't ever hate your country.
Okay. And is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
Gosh, not unless there's any specifics. If we were sitting down together and I had those pictures, things might come up.
Yeah, that we might be able to
things,
do that
you know?
Sometime in the future, but for today.
No, sir. Nope.
Okay. Well, thank you. Let me go ahead and end this officially on the recording. This will end the first interview with Mr. Dave Crawley.